Okay, Revelation chapter 18. And we're looking in this section from verse 9 through 19 with the destruction of this Babylon and the mourning over her that took place by those that had prospered from her wealth, particularly the merchants and then the kings of the earth. Starting in verse 9. So we had read that down 9 through 19 a couple of weeks ago when we were last in this study. The merchants of the earth in verse 11 of Revelation 18 were mourning over the city because no man would buy their merchandise anymore. And then it names in verse 12 a lot of the specific things that they trafficked in at that time. And it mentions gold and silver and precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple silk, scarlet, thyme wood, all manner of vessels of ivory, and all manner of vessels of most precious wood, and a brass, iron, marble. And in verse 13, it continues with cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour, wheat, beasts, sheep, horses, chariots, and then slaves and the souls of men. But most of those things that are named there in verses 12 and 13, you know, in and of themselves, are they evil things? I mean, those are just regular things. What does he say about those things? And that brings us to verse 14. Let's go ahead and read 14 down through 19, and then we'll pick it up from there. Brother Dave, can you read that for us, please?
And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and good are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and say, Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple, and scarlet, and decked with gold, and precious stones, and pearls. For in 1 hour so great riches is coming off. And every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors, as many as trade by sea, stood afar off, and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, alas, that great city wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour she was made desolate.
Okay, so again we see the suddenness of the destruction of this city, and that was something that was already mentioned a few verses up, and how sudden that came within an hour. It said again in verse 10, and so we noted that back at that point. When God brings His judgment, is it always with advance warning, other than the general warnings that come in His Word that we'd better be obedient to the Lord and seek Him and serve Him and stay away from wickedness? I mean, other than that, and then the Lord, of course, warns us of the consequences if we don't listen to Him. But the Lord's judgment, is it always something that has a forewarning, or does God many times bring a finality to things very suddenly and without warning? And we know that's the case, and that happens even in this life still sometimes. Now, we have noted, of course, the ultimate judgment, and that's involved here in this subject from Revelation chapter 18 when he's describing the judgment of this Babylon. I mean, this has been associated with the world in contrast to God's servants. And we've been seeing that contrast going all the way back to chapter 12. But we've over and over again gotten to see glimpses of here's what happens to those who follow the Lamb, who serve Christ. Here's what happens now, but here's what's going to happen in eternity. And then, on the other hand, those who are not serving the Lord. Now, we have seen in a number of occasions, as we've gone through that, a number of the passages between chapters 12 all the way to where we are here. Sometimes what happens in this life, at least for a while, it may seem to be opposite or backwards from the way it should be, because we can certainly see how the righteous suffer great affliction many times in this life, and how many times throughout these chapters have we seen the wicked bring persecution upon God's people, and at least from an earthly standpoint appear to be prevailing in it, and then seem to be prospering in their wickedness. And we see that also of that Babylon. I mean, up until that point of destruction, and all the wickedness and abominations that were there, was there any reason for them to be concerned or alarmed or think that there was any problem coming? No. In that very place, it described that woman in chapter 17, that is that city, being drunk with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So in addition to all the pleasures and abominations there, there was lots of persecution of the righteous, those that would not follow those wicked ways. And of course, we see that very often. But for a time, it seemed, well, there's no punishment coming on them for that. And here are God's people suffering persecution and many of them death. But then what happens afterwards? And we've seen that over and over again. I mean, who's standing on, in chapter 14, who was standing on that holy hill of Zion with the Lamb in the hereafter? Well, it's His people. And in chapter 15... who was standing on the sea of glass, having the harps of God, singing that new song? It was the Lord's people, the ones who had gotten the victory over the beast and over its mark and its image. And who were the ones that suffered the outpouring of God's wrath and all those plagues? But those same wicked ones. We saw that in chapter 14. And then again, particularly in chapter 16, with the pouring out of those seven last plagues. And then he starts with the subject of the destruction of that great city that was the source of so much of that in chapter 17, down to right where we are now seeing at this moment that destruction. But there's definitely the reminder of what's going to come in the ultimate judgment in the hereafter. Yet at the same time, we do know that sometimes things still happen in this life, and God used the original Babylon and its destruction as a symbol of that. And there's a reason why he's referring to this city as Babylon. Symbolically, it was so. And how many of the scriptures back in the Old Testament have we gone back to and seen pieces of where it's even word by word, some quotations of some of the things that were prophesied against the original Babylon? Babylon has fallen. In some of those other passages, we've gotten to see a lot of that. And what we're seeing here in Revelation 18 now with this destruction and the loss of all those material things, that also is something that God had said was going to happen at that first Babylon. I mean, how prosperous was the Babylonian Empire in its day? I mean, that was the top. I mean, that was... in the image that Nebuchadnezzar, that vision that he was given in Daniel chapter 2, that Daniel was given the interpretation of, and there was that image with the four parts that had the head of gold. Who was the head of gold of that image? It was Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Daniel said, "Thou art the head of gold." Well, I mean, now what does that tell you about Babylon? And then that second kingdom, he said, would be inferior to Babylon, the Persian, Medes and Persians, the Persian Empire, which was a great one. As far as what it reached at its height in prosperity and everything, it didn't quite measure up to Babylon. And the Lord said so, even ahead of time. Very prosperous. One of the it's still known today, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, as they call it, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I mean, it was known for its beauty and wealth and its high walls, and I mean, they all of those things. Well, it was a prosperous place and full of wealth and, of course, wickedness. But if we can go back to the Old Testament for a moment, to the book of Jeremiah, to chapter 50, we'll see a couple of verses here that we can compare with where we are in Revelation 18. But Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 37, Brother Glenn, can you read that for us, please?
Swords upon their horses and upon their chariots and upon all the mingled people that are in the midst of her, and they shall become as women. A sword is upon her treasures, and they shall be robbed.
All right, now perhaps I should have mentioned that the end of verse 34, he's talking about the inhabitants of which place here?
Babylon.
Yes, Babylon. And then he said in verse 35, a sword is upon the Chaldeans. So the subject there is Babylon and its inhabitants. And what was God pronouncing against it in this prophecy in verse 37? A sword upon their horses and chariots and all their people in the midst of her. And a sword is upon her treasures, and they will be robbed. What was going to become of all the material wealth of that place? Just gone. And was it going to be a slow decline, just a very lengthy period of becoming less and less prosperous over a number of years? Not at all. I mean, they were up here at the top, and it was going to go from that to nothing suddenly. Well, let's look at chapter 51 and verse 13. Let's see. But Stephen, can you read that? Stephen Reinhardt? Jeremiah 51:13. All right, now what did, even back in Revelation chapter 17, that woman was described as sitting upon many what? Many waters. So, I mean, using the very terms here again. So we see that once more. But what does he say about the treasures of this city here, of this original Babylon? The end was come. And he said the measure of her covetousness. So it was a wealthy place full of covetousness, but it was going to suddenly go like that. When did it happen? Well, we have Daniel chapter 5. Now, this was after the days of Nebuchadnezzar. A lot of times in the Bible, and we still speak this way now, but particularly in the Bible, we will read about somebody who's a descendant being the son of. What was Jesus known as? In fact, Jesus used that when he put to silence the Pharisees at the time when they kept asking him all those questions and is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar? And what did he say? He asked for the coin, and whose superscription is on it? Caesar's. And he said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and unto God what is God's. They had no answer for that. They were trying to trap him. Then the Sadducees with that hypothetical situation of the woman that was married to a man and bore no children, he died, and by the law of Moses, then she became the wife of the brother, and then so on through seven. They all died, no children. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection? They thought they had a clever situation that could somehow disprove the resurrection. What did Jesus say? In the resurrection, there is no marriage nor giving in marriage. He says, like the angels. He said, you do err not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. And then he quoted from Exodus 3, I am the God of Abraham and of Isaac and Jacob. Not I was, but he said, I am. And so he used that scripture as proof God was presently claiming 400 years after their deaths to be their God. So there is a resurrection. And then the one tempted him, what is the great commandment in the law? And he gave the answer, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two laws hang all the law and prophets. Then Jesus, he then asked a question. And he quoted from the Psalms, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. Psalm 110, verse 1. And so he said, if David calls him Lord, then how is he his son? Did they have an answer for that? What was Jesus known as? You remember the lepers when he was going out of Jericho and, O son of David, have mercy on us. He was called the son of David. Well, was he? And that's what Jesus referred to himself as there in that with that question. He was David's son, yet he was David's Lord too. How can that be? Well, we know the answer to that. He was physically descended from David through his lineage, but he pre-existed David as the one as divinity and the one that the Father created all things, including David, by. And all of us. So he was the creator and then was sent to this earth through the lineage of David as his son. But he was also his Lord as he was his maker. So there's an answer for that. But he was the son of David. But was he, did that mean David was his immediate ancestors, his actual father? And he was the next generation? No. But being a descendant of, they could be referred to as the son of. As it says in the lineage of Christ in Matthew 1, he's the son of Abraham and the son of David. So being a descendant of made him the son of from that standpoint. Well, why am I mentioning that? Here in Daniel 5, Belshazzar is, it mentions him, his father Nebuchadnezzar, and he's called the son of Nebuchadnezzar. In actuality, from the records, we know he was technically his grandson. But, I mean, that's fine. That's not a problem for it to be worded that way. Because he was his descendant, but there was one between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar who had only a very brief reign as king of Babylon. So Belshazzar took the throne, and so he was not long after Nebuchadnezzar. He was the next prominent ruler of Babylon and the last one. So Babylon reached a great height. So it was a very mighty and prosperous kingdom, but its duration was not very long. Now, Persia didn't reach Babylon's height, but it endured much longer. But Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 5, what was he doing there in verse 1? Well, Daniel 5:1 says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast with 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. So does it sound like he was poor? Not at all. But he did something very foolish there. He used the vessels, it says in verse 2, the vessels that had come from God's temple that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. But Nebuchadnezzar at least had sense enough to lock them away. But Belshazzar brings it out to have a feast with his lords to get drunk with and worship idols with, which is what it says in verse 3. They brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. The king, his princes, his wives, concubines drank in them. They drank wine, praised the gods of gold and of silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone. And what happened in the same hour in Daniel 5:5? The famous handwriting on the wall. That's when God's hand came. I mean, God made a hand appear, wrote on the wall, and then Daniel got called to interpret the writing, and did. And what did the interpretation of the writing mean? That gets down near the end of the chapter in verse 26. This is the interpretation of the thing. Many, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Perez, the kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Well, here he is in the middle of this feast. Does it sound like that the empire has declined and he's just reigning over just the poor remnants of what Nebuchadnezzar had built? No. I mean, it's still at its height. But he says it's finished. Just like we saw in the prophecies there in Jeremiah 50 and verse in chapter 51 in those verses we read. He said, your treasures are coming to an end, and your covetousness, all those things, they're done. Well, here they are at the beginning of the chapter, not done right there, is it? Here's 1,000 of his lords, they're having a drunken feast. But while they're doing that, little do they know that Cyrus the Great, the Persian leader, had diverted the waters that flowed under the walls of Babylon from the Euphrates River, and then he and his army went under the walls and came into that city that night when they were in the middle of doing all of that. And what did he say there at the end of the chapter? What does it say that happened? Well, it says in verse 29, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Not for long. In verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. That's the one that Cyrus put in place in the city of Babylon. When did it happen? Verse 30, in that night. So how sudden was the end of Babylon? And that's what he's using as a symbol there in Revelation 18. And all of its prosperity, how sudden was the loss of all of that? How sudden is the loss of many, whether it's on a scale of a city or nation or kingdom or even individuals? I mean, how often does it happen that someone, without any forewarning at all, that somebody wakes up in the morning and they begin their last day on this earth and have no idea that they're not going to see another day? And at whatever point and whatever way, that whatever they have, it's all gone. Done. I mean, it can happen that way, and many times does. Well, the question is, are we ready for whenever that? We don't know when our end is going to come, by death or by the Lord coming back. I mean, Jesus could return any moment. We don't know when our end or how it's going to be. So what did Jesus say the wise will be doing? We don't know what hour he's going to return. So what is the message? Watch. And how do we watch? He says, blessed are they, when his Lord shall come, they shall find so doing his will. That's how we watch. We don't just sit there and stare up at the sky. We're watching, we're being ready, watchful for his return by serving him diligently right now. That's how we prepare ourselves to be ready for that. Well, if we're doing the Lord's will all the time, then at whatever moment he returns or our end comes, what are we going to be doing? We'll be doing the Lord's will. I mean, that's all we should be doing. And then if that's what we're doing, do we need to be troubled? We don't need to be troubled by it then. But if we're not ready, we need to be troubled and do something about it so we don't end up having this happen that he's describing here. But this Babylon of Revelation 18, I mean, he's using what happened to that first one as the symbol of this one. It's a symbol of God's judgment. And then he's naming all these things that were there in that city and what happened to it. He says, within an hour, it's all gone. So was anybody thinking that was going to be it for that place? No. Just like the original one. And so then they're all mourning over the loss of those things. And the sad thing is, because and I know we, a couple weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, whatever, we put that up here on the board. We listed a bunch of these things. Are these, which things that does he describe in that city are wicked things, sinful things? I mean, it was a mother of abominations of the earth. That was what was on her, among the things written on her forehead in chapter 17. Was there sin in that place? Yes, lots of it. But was everything sinful? No. A lot of it was just wealth and pleasure. But what does God warn us about of those things? And we looked at that. I mean, there in Matthew chapter 6. We all know it's Matthew 6:33. starts with the word seek. Seek ye, what is it? Those words should be written up there. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. What things? What are the things He said not to take thought, that is, care for? Food, drink, and clothes. After all these things do the Gentiles, the nations seek. Food, drink, and clothes. Can food, drink, and clothes become a stumbling block? Yeah. I mean, that we love those things. We can get just even those basic necessities of life. I mean, just look at, again, all those things that He names there. Well, I mean, is it a sin to have cinnamon? No, but can you make... What if we really love cinnamon? I mean, what if that becomes, you know, that's where our care is? If we love the things of the world, then what does that mean? That's 1 John 2:15, isn't it? If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. What did Jesus say? No man can serve two masters. He will hate the one and love the other, else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, material things. Matthew 6:24 and Luke 16:13. You can't serve God and material things. Can't do both. Can't have two masters. It's a choice, either or. It's this world and its things. Because a lot of times we might in our minds think, well, as long as we just avoid the sinful things. And that's a big point we've been trying to make out of this. It's not, the line here isn't, okay, find where sin is and stay away from it. That was the chart we put up here. In fact, I can barely still see the remnants of that on there. But we had three spaces there. I'm not going to recreate it now. But you remember, we don't just have one line, sin and not sin. And as long as we stay away from that line, we're fine. And that's the way a lot of people look at it. I mean, that's better than sinning, of course, but that's not the extent of what our understanding should be, and that's not the actual standard we should have. You remember we looked at James 1:19 and 20. I know we're reviewing a little bit now. But James 1:19 and 20, be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Why should we be slow to anger? For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. That's James 1:20. So there's the reason not to have it, even though, as we've noted, Ephesians 4, verse 26 says, be angry and sin not. Same exact word. The Greek word orge. So it's not inherently sinful, but he says, don't do it. Put it all away, Ephesians 4:31, and then he gives the reason in James 1:20. It doesn't work God's righteousness. So here's something that's not technically... It can lead to sin. That's one of its problems. But it's... not inherently, automatically a sin. It's possible to not sin being angry, but he says don't do it because it doesn't work God's righteousness. And how many things can we look at like that? Well, I mean, being the having your life wrapped up in cinnamon, I mean, it might say, well, that's not really a sin, but starts with that. But anyway, if that's what we love, then can we love God? If cinnamon's my life, I mean, cinnamon can't be my master and the Lord. And I know it's kind of silly looking at that, but we can go down the list of any of those things. And it's true, it's real, all of that. Lay aside every weight and the sin that doth so easily beset you. Hebrews 12:1. Every weight, anything that hinders us, that weights us down, that would be an obstacle for us to be able to run the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And it's not just sins. He says, lay aside every weight and the sin. So anything that could entangle us. A good soldier does not entangle himself in the affairs of this life. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, he teaches in those first four verses what it means to be a good soldier. We can't be tangled up in the affairs of this life. That doesn't mean it has to be sinful things. Luke 8:14, when he uses a form, because we've mentioned, and when he says, take no thought for what you shall eat or what you shall drink or wherewithal you shall be clothed in Matthew 6, he says that's the verb. That's the action. Don't take thought. Don't take care. The noun form of it is cares, which is in Luke 8:14, in the parable of the sower. Those who are choked by the cares and riches and pleasures of this life. the cares of it. That's the noun form of what the verb is when he says, take no thought for food, drink, and clothes. So he already used that same word and made an application to the necessities of life. Our food, drink, and clothes. And said that the Gentiles, the nations, seek after those things, but we're not to do that. We're to seek God and His righteousness. What can happen? We can get wrapped up and entangled with those things that will choke us and prevent us from bringing fruit to perfection. What's the difference between being choked and not bringing fruit to completion versus being weighted down and not being able to finish our race? I mean, it's two different ways of teaching the same point, isn't it? Choked or weighted and slowed down. We're not going to finish the job if we're dragging around that stuff or we're choked by it. So he's teaching that here in Revelation 18. What's the problem with those things? What's the problem with cinnamon? I mean, what's the problem with water? I mean, water is no problem if we're drinking it to live, to use our life to serve God. It's flavoring our food with salt or cinnamon. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, if we're eating that for strength to serve the Lord with. But if that's what becomes our care and love, then we got a problem. Because we can't serve that and God at the same time. But what's the whole problem with all that's in the world? Even these things that he's naming right there, you know, all the nice things, the pearls and gold and silver and precious stones and purple and silk and scarlet and all these nice drinking vessels and all these spices and perfumes. And I mean, who doesn't like something that smells nice? I mean, who doesn't like, you know, potpourri and nice smelling candles and all that kind of stuff? But we can become, well, if we don't, our wives do. But anyway, we can become wrapped up in those things. It can be anything. It can be. Does the devil care if he can make candles my master? Whatever he can do to make it not Christ, he'll be very happy with. But all of these things of this world, what is the problem with it? Why do they belong in their place of it for whatever purpose that we can? That it will sustain our lives so we can use our strength and health and all that God gives us to serve Him with. You know, when God saw all that He made, He said it was good. It was good for His purpose. And that's His purpose for those things, to give us life so that we can use that life to serve Him with. But when we take those things to become what we love, what we enjoy, what we serve, then that it's not good for that. And why not? What's He say in verse 14? All the fruits that your soul lusted after, what happened to them all? Everything they loved, what happened? Gone. He says, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. When would they ever get it back? You know, whatever point I leave this world, I'm not getting another sniff of cinnamon. I mean, that's it. I do like cinnamon, but I mean, that's going to be it. I mean, I wasn't planning on pressing cinnamon to be the big focus here tonight, but anyway, it's kind of worked out that way. But I mean, if that's what my life is, and then when I leave here, then where is it? It's gone. And so, I mean, the point is using those illustrations that it can be anything like that. And we need to keep that in perspective that all of these things, everything in this world is going to be gone. All right, we mentioned in 1 John 2 again, but let's go back over there and read 1 John 2, 15 through 17 to see the emphasis on that point about the duration. What lasts and what doesn't? 1 John 2, 15 through 17, Brother Tom.
Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever.
So what does he say about all these things in the world? It passes away. Whoever's doing God's will is going to abide forever. And all the things that are involved in that, all those things that he tells us to seek after, that abides. 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verses 7 through 11. Brother Stephen, 1 Timothy 6, 7 through 11.
We brought up in the prison world, and it is certain we can carry enough to help us. To have food and raiment, let us be there with content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and to many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For love of money is the root of all evil, which, while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith, pierce themselves through many sorrows. But thou, O man of God, flee these things, and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness.
And I know we've mentioned it before, but verse 10, money itself, is that an inherently sinful thing? No. And we have to use it to buy the things that we have to live. And we're commanded to give it every first day of the week. But what about loving it? That's the root of all evil. And what does he say about those? And we don't even have to be rich. In verse 9, they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and hurtful lusts. I mean, if that becomes what our focus is, Proverbs 23:4 says, labor not to be rich. Cease from thine own wisdom, the word for understanding. When we lean to our own wisdom and understanding, it says, hey, we need to go out there. The reason we need to be working is to get more stuff. But is that wise or foolish? It's foolish, because what of all those things? That desire, well, we're not going to be, if that's what we're desiring, I mean, we're not going to be able to serve the Lord at the same time, as Jesus said. We can't serve God in these material things. And that will cause us to err from the faith, and we will be pierce ourselves through with many sorrows. So he says, flee these things. Well, flee what? A love of these material things. He doesn't say don't ever eat or eat a meal or drink any water, but a love of those things, flee that. Run from that. What should we be running towards or following after? How long does righteousness last? If our heart is formed in righteousness,
forever.
Glenn, if you die righteous, are you no longer righteous when you die? Are you righteous? Does that go on? If that's your heart, you take that with you? I mean, that's what we're taught to follow after, and for that reason. Godliness. If we're formed in godliness, do we lose that at death? Do we leave the godliness behind? Our faith, love, patience, meekness, any of that, do we leave any of that behind? Or is our heart eternal? Well, that's 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We have to keep in perspective the material things, the physical things, the temporal things, versus the eternal things. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18. Brother Ted?
For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yea, an inward man is renewed day by day. For our light, which is much but for a moment, working for us a far more exceedingly and eternal way of glory. While ye work not at the things which are seen, all the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal.
All right, how many parts are there of us are there, broadly speaking, in verse 16? Yeah. Now, as far as the world is concerned, where's the emphasis? Outward. And how long does that last? Yep. And, I mean, all the, whatever the creams or ointments, medicines, facelifts, and plastic surgery, whatever, there's no stopping it. What's going to happen? And how much do people go through to try to avoid what's inevitable? And it's because, I mean, what the care for the outer part of us. How long does this physical body last? I mean, it's not long. You know, as James 4 puts it, with our life is but a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. And we know we're not going to be here very long. And he's mentioning that there in verse 16. Our outward man perishes. The majority of us in here, I hate to say it, but the majority of us in this room right now, our strongest point physically is in our past. There are a few of you that are either still hanging in there or kind of right at that plateau or not quite there. But it comes very quickly, and then we're past it. And then we get way past it pretty fast. And I wasn't here last Wednesday night because my teeth aren't holding up like they used to. I mean, we get those kinds of reminders, don't we? I mean, our backs, our teeth, and all kinds of things. And, Tom hadn't had any, no reminders for you, right? Yeah. So, we've all got them. And if we pay attention to it, it's saying, hey, this physical part of us, it's not going to last. And, I mean, even if we got the full 4 score years or beyond, we make it to 100. I mean, that's a big milestone. But really, what's 100 years? I know one isn't what it used to be, or it doesn't seem like it. But anyway, it goes fast. This part is not where our focus should be. What about the other part? The inward man. I mean, that's what 1 Timothy 6 is about. Those things that pertain to the inner man. If we're following after righteousness and godliness and faith and patience and meekness, godliness, we're going to have that. That will be, if that's what our inner man is formed in, we should be getting stronger day by day in all of those things. And when we leave this life, all that we have of that, we take with us. So that, you know, in Luke 16, we remember that beggar Lazarus. I mean, what did he have physically in this life? He had a lot of sores, dogs licking him, begging crumbs from a rich man's table. But what was he? Was he really a poor man? Materially, yes. But then, I mean, that life ended quickly. And he's in Abraham's bosom because he was a righteous man. He loved the Lord and served the Lord, poor as he was. And then you had that rich man on the other hand. How suddenly did all of his that he had come to an end? And everything that he desired and loved, it was gone. And so what did he have? I mean, he wakes up in torment. He doesn't have anything anymore, anything that he loves. And who becomes the beggar? He's begging. Send Lazarus over to cool my tongue. Send Lazarus back from the dead for my brother's sake. I mean, he's begging. It becomes reversed there. He's poor and begging, but because he's poor spiritually. And that's the saddest thing. But that's not the way it should be for us. I know we've mentioned it before, but the day we die should be that's obviously our weakest point physically, but that should be our strongest point as far as where our inner man is. And he makes it very clear in verse 18 why that's the case. He says, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. Why? What about the things that are seen? What does he say about them? They're temporal. The things that are not seen are eternal. So righteousness, godliness, faith, and meekness, and patience, and all of that, that's all eternal. those things he teaches us to follow after for our inner man to be formed in. If that's what we love and seek after, we take every bit of that with us when we die. So if that's what we love, we lose nothing. And that's the way it should be. So we have the reminder of that in Revelation 14. What we love, and if it's the right things, we don't ever lose it. But if it's the wrong things, there's going to come that point where it's all gone and it's never coming back. Which is very sad for those in that situation, because they don't have anything in eternity for good. As we finish up that passage in Revelation 18, the merchants of those things that were made rich by that city, they stood afar off, which is exactly what he said in verse 10. They were standing far off for the fear of her torment. It says it again there in verse 15, standing afar off for fear of her torment. They don't want to get caught up in it. They're sad about it, but they don't want to be part of the destruction themselves. But they are standing there far off, weeping, wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught. And every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors and many as trade by sea stood afoot." So, I mean, the goods of this place were being carried far and wide, but all the merchants, all those that were involved with shipping those goods, and they're all prospering off of it, but it's all gone. Their livelihood is gone. They're all crying and weeping over that. What city is like unto this great city? And then they cast dust on their heads, cried, weeping and wailing. Alas, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea, by reason of her costliness, and for 1 hour she made desolate. So that's the perspective of those who loved those things of the world. We don't want to be like that. Now, as we read further here, starting at verse 20, we get the perspective of the other side. In verses 20 through 24, if we can go back there and read that. Brother Dave, can you read 20 through 24 from Revelation 18?
"Rejoice over her, by heaven, and behold, the apostles of prophets, for God has avenged you on her. And my angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians and pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all. No craftsman or whatsoever craft can do shall be found any more in thee, and the sound of the millstone shall be heard no more at all in thee, and the light of the candle shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for our sorceries were all nations and cities. In her was found the blood of prophets and saints and all that were slain from the earth."
Okay. Now, verse 20, we have to be careful with this verse and this passage down through the end of the chapter, when he says, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets." Now, if we don't rightly divide and discern this carefully, we could come to the wrong idea very quickly here and actually be in conflict with God's teachings in many other places in His Word. So that's why we have to compare spiritual things with spiritual. Clearly there's something to rejoice in here in verse 20, but we can look at other scriptures and see that there would be things not to rejoice in this situation. Well, let's think of God Himself and His perspective on it. Well, God is accomplishing His purpose here in punishing the wicked. God does that. That's His work. In fact, that's His work alone. What does He tell us about that in Romans chapter 12? And we have to keep this in mind, because it can it can be a temptation for us to try to take God's job over and do it ourselves, which is not appropriate at all. The Lord tells us about that. In Romans 12, let's read verses 19 through 21. Let's see, Brother Glenn, you got that? Romans 12, 19.
Dearly beloved, repent not yourself, but rather your place under wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him, if he thirst, give him drink. When so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. He not overcomes evil, but overcomes evil and good.
Okay, so who does vengeance belong to? And punishment and all that. To God and God alone, that's not our place. Now, when God does that, well, the wicked are going to be the ones that are going to be suffering God's judgment at that time. All right, well, when that involves the end of someone's life on this earth, or in some cases, it may be a massive loss of life, when God makes the decision, He's always righteous in His judgments. He knows exactly what to do, when to do it, how to do it, and He does it right. There's much of that that we do not know the details of because He and He only knows the hearts of all men. That's why He's qualified to do these things. We can't see the things that God can see, like that. So, but when that happens, how does God feel about when He takes a soul from this life that's wicked? What does that mean for that soul? When someone dies in their sins, what does that mean for them from that point? That's a lost soul for eternity. Now, how many people that are lost in that condition believe that they're lost, understand that they're lost, and even if you told them, would believe that and do something about it? Sadly, very, very few. Still our job to carry the gospel to the world, even though few there be that find it. But it doesn't change the fact that those who are lost are lost, and whether they know it or not. But when they are lost and they're lost for eternity, well, who made them? God did. So how does God feel about the loss of a soul? Ezekiel 33 verse 11 tells us. But Stephen Reinhardt, can you read that? Ezekiel 33 and verse 11. So does God, is He happy with losing a soul for eternity? Well, He so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. I mean, that's how much He loved the world. And all these souls in their wickedness. I mean, Romans 5, did Jesus die for us when we were godly and righteous? In our sins. That's how much He loves the souls that He's made. And when He loses one, that gives Him no pleasure. Does that mean He's not going to bring that judgment on the ones that rebel against Him and will not repent? No. But His desire is that they would repent and live. But when they refuse it, eventually He's going to exercise His judgment on them. But the losing the soul, or many souls, that doesn't give God pleasure. We need to remember that perspective of God. If we turn to Proverbs 24, He wants us to have the same kind of heart. Proverbs 24. In verse 17. Proverbs 24, verse 17, Brother Tom.
Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth.
All right, so does the Lord want us to rejoice over the wicked perishing? No. God doesn't, and he doesn't want us to do that. We better be careful to avoid that, because we're commanded to love our enemies. That's part of what Jesus taught, Matthew 5:43-48. You've heard that it's been said to love your neighbor and hate your enemies. But I say unto you, love your enemies. So Jesus taught us to love our enemies. He did. That's the love of God. That's why he said in verse 48, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. We need to be complete in our love to include loving our enemies. That's the love of God. That's the kind of love that we need to have in our hearts too. We need to be like him. Let's turn to the book of Job very quickly before we close tonight. Verses 29 to 30. Here was a complete man, a perfect man, and upright, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. We've been studying about him recently. But Job 31, 29 and 30. Let's see the understanding that this man who was complete in his love, what he had on that. Brother Stephen Jackson.
I rejoice that the church and I did lift up myself from evil's mountain. Neither have I sought
So he said there in verses 29 and 30, did he rejoice at the destruction of those who hated him? And when evil found him, did Job rejoice at that? Did Job wish a curse to the souls of his enemies? I mean, this is a man, look at the understanding he had. That was Job. So, of course, that's the kind of heart we need to have. In Revelation 18 and verse 20, when he says, rejoice over her, was it to be happy that those wicked people were now destroyed? That's not what he says to rejoice over. So what were they to be rejoicing over? Well, in verse 20, he says, now heaven and you holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. It was God's judgment, his righteous judgment. Could they rejoice in God doing what God is supposed to do in executing his righteous judgments, but not be happy that those souls were lost? Yes, and there's a line of distinction there. We have to be able to make that discernment. We'll do some more on that in our study, Lord willing, next week. We're out of time now. Those are some interesting but important points there. So we'll try to go in and dig through that a little bit more.